o'clock on the dot on Monday, April 14th. And before we begin, we'll do the Pledge of Allegiance. Board Member Hansen, do you mind leading us in the pledge?
Please stand for the pledge.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, and we'll go ahead and start with a roll call.
Yes, good evening. Board Member Hom.
Here.
Board Member Sue.
Here.
Board Member Ruiz.
Here.
Board Member Ariza.
Present.
Board Member Sahiba.
Present.
And President Cisneros.
Here.
We have a quorum with one absence.
Okay, great. Moving on to agenda item 3, any non-agenda public comments? Anyone either, there's no one in the room, in the room or virtually, can speak for 3 minutes for anything that's not on the agenda. Do we have any speakers?
We do not have any speakers with raised hands.
Okay. All right. And then with that, we'll go ahead and close agenda item 3. And we'll move on to the consent calendar, which was just one item, the draft meeting minutes for March 10th. If no comments, do we have a motion?
I abstained because I wasn't here.
Okay. Thank you. We have one abstention. Any motion?
I move approval.
Okay.
I second.
Great. We have a motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed. And one abstention.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Moving on to a regular agenda item, we have 5A, which is an amendment to the zoning ordinance for universal design. Do we have a presentation from staff?
We do. There we go, coming up. Planning board members, President, thank you very much for your time this evening. Here to discuss the proposed amendments to the Universal Design Ordinance. We have a staff report for you, which I want to acknowledge was, and our proposed ordinance, which was briefly amended this morning to reflect some changes that were intended to be included in the original. So that includes removal of a superlative, a brief reordering of a subsection, and amendments to the annual reporting guidelines to be consistent with the annual reporting already conducted for the housing element. And so with that out of the way, we have before you a series of proposed amendments. You probably recall our study session regarding these amendments, and so we've sort of brought before you a revised version of the ordinance that reflects many of the changes that we had discussed during our past meeting. And given that we've had some time to discuss this, I will kind of give a summary review of the proposed amendments, and we'll then open it up to any questions. So you may recall that many of the really consequential amendments proposed to the Universal Design Ordinance had to do with providing an exemption to specifically small townhome projects from specific aspects of the Universal Design Ordinance in order to reflect the sort of practice of the city and to reflect the design of these particular building types. You may recall that in the past, townhouse projects have had to request a waiver before the planning board or leverage a density bonus in order to exempt themselves from these requirements, and so instead, the exemption is intended to address that. The fact that townhomes can't meet certain aspects of those visibility universal design requirements. And so just to help clarify and set the stage a little bit, the Universal Design Ordinance is really sort of divided into two major groups of requirements. Visibility requirements, which are applied to 100% of all new housing development in the city, and has to do with requiring both accessible entry and certain types of accessible rooms on the ground floor area of a new unit. That's sort of contrasted with the universal design requirements, which only apply to 30% of residential units, new residential units, excuse me, for projects that have at least 5 proposed units. However, those requirements are more expansive. They require a greater number of rooms on the ground floor and additional requirements associated with a fewer number of units for a given development. The overall purpose is to basically allow these projects that can't meet these requirements without a waiver to have a built-in exemption to update the ordinance and make sure that references to individuals and bodies are accurate with their current names, and just to reflect sort of best practice with regard to the verbiage in the ordinance. The actual text of the amendment we went through in quite some detail last time, so I think we can drill down on specific amendments as needed. There were a couple of specific changes from the last meeting that I would like to sort of address, just because they're relatively new, or at least have changed somewhat since the last meeting. I think I mentioned some of the ones that were changed from this morning, but in addition to that, there's been sort of a reordering of the exact exemptions so that they're a little bit clearer. Section 7A and 7B, sort of making it clear that they're two exemptions that are falling under the same type of construction, one that's more narrow than the other. Some added definitions and some added clarity to some of the existing definitions, as well as some of the titles. You'll notice that the waiver of the building official has now been separated from waivers by the planning board. That was a suggestion from our city's attorney's office, which I think helps clarify that these are independent of one another. And so those are sort of the majority of the changes. The new matrix, which I think sort of reflects the most important change, shows that the new criterion for the exemption 7B has been changed from a site area to a unit number threshold. The thinking behind this is that, they achieve sort of largely the same purpose. You'll see here, if you sort of look at the matrix starting in the upper right-hand corner and working our way right to left, for small projects that have large floor areas, no exemptions apply, and so they need to go through the typical waiver process for relief. That's because if they're a large development and they don't meet that criteria for floor area, they're likely not a townhome development, and therefore this is not meant to target them. The next sort of block over the matrix to the right shows our first exemption, which is for these townhome style projects that have that small floor area but are part of a larger development. They only get to benefit from 7A, which means they'll have narrow exemptions for things like the accessible entrance, but they'll still be required to have other aspects of accessibility which can be applied to these townhome style developments, including block within the walls, accessible open space, and other features. So the next sort of two allow us to sort of demonstrate how the unit count criterion is a little bit more effective at targeting the type of projects we're hoping to facilitate with this. And so before, you may recall, it was a 3-acre threshold. Now instead we've established a 10-unit threshold. And the reason for that number specifically is that when you're proposing a development with at least 10 units, you trigger the inclusionary housing ordinance. And when you do that, you'll have to include deed-restricted housing as part of your project. When you have affordable housing as part of the project, you're eligible for a density bonus. And projects able to leverage this density bonus don't necessarily need to use an exemption to get a quote-unquote waiver from these types of requirements. And so for projects that have many units, larger developments, but that are doing a townhome style development, we'll start with that aren't, obviously no exemptions apply, it would need a waiver. But for projects that do sort of meet this criterion and are developing townhomes but have enough units in their project site that they can hypothetically diversify their building types to have other types of buildings that can meet the criteria, at least 30% of them, they'll still be required to meet the 30% universal design requirement under 7B, in addition to the other accessibility requirements that would still be required under 7A. So hopefully that clarifies a little bit. You can think of it as, you know, when you have a large project that has these townhome style developments, they still need to meet universal design because they can diversify the building types. But of course, if you have a very small development, think, you know, between 5 and 9 townhome style units, it's not feasible to meet the 30% universal design requirement, and therefore they're additionally exempted from that. And I'm happy to spend a little more time on this if we need to. But with that in mind, I'd like to open it up to the board for any questions, comments, concerns we may have.
Thank you so much for the presentation. Any clarifying questions? Board Member Hom?
Yep, thank you for the presentation. And some of my questions may be based on reviewing the prior, before you revised it. It sounds like some of the revisions you did probably addresses some of my questions that I have. But I looked at the ordinance from the standpoint of someone that needs to administer and interpret the ordinance to the developer. So with that in mind, there's some questions regarding the ordinance that not quite clear in my mind, so I just wanted to pose it for clarification. My understanding is the way how the process is defined, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that for both the feasibility and the university sign requirements, the building official can make a finding of exception based on financial hardship in either one?
That is correct.
Okay. Ordinance is not quite as explicit there, but maybe the new revision helps clarify that. The second question I have is regarding the 20% threshold, which you explained in the staff report, that using the Uniform Building Code as the standard. I guess my question is it truly black and white? In other words, if someone, a developer comes in and says these both, is it combined both in universal design requirements as well as the feasibility requirements exceed 20%,
exactly,
then I'm 100% exempt from the requirements, period. Is that true? And if I'm below the, say someone comes in and they're only at 18%, then the requirements still apply. Is there any area where the building official or the planning board can make a determination like, okay, you know, we'll reduce your requirement from 100% feasibility to say 25 or 35% such that it brings it down to a reasonable level and won't create that financial hardship that over 20%? Or is it truly black and white? Either you meet it or you don't have to meet it. I'm just trying to understand how it's going to be administered.
I think that's a very good question. As it's currently written, it is, as you say, black and white. It is a sort of, So I think as it says here, it looks like the waiver from the building official can effectively waive any of the requirements of it. So they could hypothetically waive, you know, for example, only a portion of it. But I think the thing to keep in mind here is that this building official waiver is intended to be very narrow. For example, they have to demonstrate that it's from topological conditions, and they don't have equivalent facilitation or other ways to sort of achieve that, and that truly there are no other options besides an option that is financially infeasible. So I think there's sort of two questions here. The question is to whether or not the 20% is black and white. Yes, the 20%, the number that they receive, it's either below or above that, and that's sort of how they make the determination. How they apply the waiver it could be interpreted by the building official.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
I guess in my opinion, it'd be good to have the ordinance clarify that gray area, because it's how I read it is black and white. Mm-hmm. So in other words, I could talk more about it, but the 100% and 30%, we both agree, and everyone agrees that's a pretty onerous requirement for townhomes. But the question is there ability to still require the requirement for either feasibility or university sign for at least a lesser number of units if a specific project could be feasible just for site reasons that maybe one of the buildings is, I'm just kind of wondering, is you know, if there's ability for that. So that's just, I'll kind of comment on that further, because I'm a little concerned about this black and white interpretation. In another question, in 30.18.3.A, there's some language that got deleted regarding past projects. So I guess I'm not clear. Is this ordinance meant to be retroactive to currently approved projects?
And I'm sorry, can you specify is exactly?
Yep. Yeah, in 30.18.3.A, there's some language deleted that seems to reflect projects that are already approved, but maybe I'm misinterpreting it. So the question is, when this ordinance gets passed, will it be retroactive to projects already approved, or projects already approved cannot take advantage of this new provision?
This is only to be applied to new projects, and the reason for this revision is a recommendation from the city attorney's office. This is sort of redundant because obviously anything submitted after the effective date of the ordinance, the ordinance applies to. And so it's sort of implied by sort of the nature under which ordinances are adopted that after the effective date, they are effective.
Okay, so it's not retroactive.
Yeah, this doesn't change any of the
I just wasn't clear with that section whether that was meant to deal with that. And the another question is maybe city attorney or yourself answering. In the staff report, it's a little confusing to me. It's tries to make the distinction between a waiver and an appeal. And I guess, and that they're different, but then the ordinance says appeal. So I guess what I'm understanding perhaps is that a waiver doesn't really require the chief building, doesn't require the planning director to make a decision, whereas an appeal does. Is that the distinction between waiver and appeal? It wasn't quite clear to me in the staff report.
Yeah, what you're identifying is a particular revision, and you're exactly right. An appeal implies that there's been a decision made that you're confronting, but specifically this had to do with a determination at a staff level that the ordinance applies to a project. Mm-hmm. And so the determination of applicability, if a applicant disagreed that the ordinance applies, the sort of correct remedy for that situation would be for them to apply for a waiver to demonstrate the ways in which the ordinance does not apply to them, not to make an appeal for a staff level determination of applicability.
So there doesn't need to be an actual staff action first before
exactly.
It goes to the planning board. Okay, that's what I kind of thought. It wasn't quite clear in the staff report. And then I have a couple of clarifying questions regarding the paragraph which I actually have most confusion about, and that's 30.18.5, the ability of the chief building official to make findings for waivers due to financial hardship. And there's a couple of items there that maybe you could explain. There's a mention of legal constraints. So I'm not sure what that means. Is that legal constraints related specifically to uniform building code requirements or some broader legal constraints that the building official will now have ability to justify the waiver on? It's just not clear. It says legal constraints, and I'm not sure what that actually, what is, like, give me an example of what's a legal constraint.
Presumably the onus would be on the applicant to demonstrate what constraints they feel apply to the project, but I can imagine that such a constraint might include something like an easement or some configuration of the parcel that makes it difficult. That could be a legal constraint, right? If there was a deed restriction or something about the parcel that precluded their access to some portion of it, mm-hmm. Or, if it was sometimes the mineral rights of a parcel are separate.
Property restriction or something.
Yeah, like legal rights in that sense.
It would be good to get that clarified, because otherwise it could be interpreted pretty broadly, at least in my opinion. And then there's another clause that I'm not sure what is meant by. Is at the end of that section, it says, or unless equivalent facilitation is not allowable or available. What does that mean?
I think this is referring to both equivalent facilitation insofar as like facilitating compliance with the building code. So there are aspects of the building code that can be complied with in a number of ways, right? And so it may not be financially feasible for a project to comply with the building code in one way. However, there may be an alternative configuration that they can comply with the building code, but, you know, it still achieves their sort of goals for the project site.
Okay.
So that would be equivalent facilitation.
So the, for instance, the building official could say, well, I think there's alternative means that you can employ to reduce the financial hardship to say due to the site configuration or something along that line.
Sure,
That's based on what's allowable under the building code.
Right. It's intended to say that you've exhausted all other options that are allowable under the building code before coming to us with this request for waiver.
It would be good to kind of clarify that the building official's realm of jurisdiction is really related to the Uniform Building Code. Anyway, that's a comment, not a question, so I'm probably overstepping. Those are my questions. Thank you.
And just to clarify, that was the equivalent facilitation piece?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, got it.
If I could chime in on that, the original ordinance was taken from a model ordinance, and the model ordinance did include this language, and so most cities did just use that language that was in the model ordinance. It's not your typical language that you see in zoning ordinances, this reasonable facilitation. So if you want to give us direction, we're happy to refine that language, but it is taken from the model ordinance.
Yeah. It'd be good, I think my comment was, it'd be good to kind of really reference that it pertains to the interpretation of the Uniform Building Code.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, great questions. Anyone else? Board Member Ruiz?
Yes, thank you so much for addressing most of my comments and the revision, and I see that that being reflected, so appreciate that. Outstanding question is, reading the ordinance that say, for example, 30-18.4, A, subparagraph 2, which is, I think, on page 3 of the new ordinance that you emailed out today, at the bottom of it, it says an accessible interior access from accessible entry to an accessible powder or bathroom, accessible common use room or an accessible bedroom, and an adaptable internal stairs. My question is, does that mean that the non-ground floor bathrooms or powder rooms need to be accessible?
If a unit is required to meet the visibility requirements, then yes, there needs to be at least a powder room or a bathroom on the ground floor that meets the accessibility requirements.
What if there's none on the ground floor? Can we go back to the slide where you show the 10 units? That say if the units, they have more than 10 units, but the ground floor habitable space is less than 150 square feet.
Then they will not need to require that because they'll be exempt from the visibility requirements.
All of it.
Except for blocking within the walls, accessible open space, and the optional features.
So help me to think through this logic.
Mm-hmm.
So they're exempt from visibility. So that means that they do not need to provide any of this. So if there's no bathroom in the ground floor, but yet there's bathroom on the second floor, we are still requiring them to put blockings in the wall even though they don't meet the visibility requirement? They don't need to comply with that?
That's correct. And the thinking behind this is that there are a wide range of disabilities that the Universal Design Ordinance is intended to help folks with, and that folks that may be able to mount that first floor staircase may still benefit from things like blocking within the walls.
Okay.
While I think it comes down to the fact that we were trying to apply these exemptions to as narrow a range of visibility requirements as possible.
Okay. And then so if it's if they have greater than 150 square foot habitable space on the first floor, what's the percentage that need to be visible? 100%, right?
Yep.
So that means all of the units, the second floor bathroom, need to be made accessible if no bathroom is provided on the ground floor.
If the visibility requirements do apply, then they will need to include a ground floor bathroom or powder room, regardless of whether they require or include, rather, a second floor bathroom.
So they're required to provide a bathroom on the ground floor?
Or a powder room if the visibility requirements apply, yes.
Okay, I can see that this can be a hardship. So just FYI.
Duly noted, thank you. And in addition, thank you for your earlier comments. Those were very helpful.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Okay, seeing none. I just had one small clarifying questions, and thanks to my fellow board members for all the great questions and addressing some of the comments, including the clarification on the 3 acre thing. I was wondering about the shift about that. Just a small thing, like in the ordinance, it says, quote, from time to time, like, let's see, like in 30-18.2. And is that to mean like when the California Building Code updates in real time, then this will, okay. And that's just like a standard
exactly.
Legal, okay.
Exactly.
Cool. Okay, I love that.
you answered your own question perfectly.
Okay. great. All right, with that, we'll go ahead and open it up to recommendations and comments. Again, this is a recommendation to City Council. So I'll open it up to the board.
Public?
Oh, public comment, yeah, thanks. first, do we have any public comment?
If any of the participants on Zoom wish to speak, please raise your hand. It appears there are none.
Okay, we'll go ahead and close public comment. Now we'll bring it back to the board for any recommendations, comments. Board Member DeWeese, or
no?
Okay. Are you sure?
No.
Okay. So thank you. I think I'm just going to go ahead and start with the language about reference about. CBC reference, California Building Code Chapter 11 as amended from time to time. I would recommend a different language like current, you know, the current version of Chapter 11A as adopted by City of Alameda, because every code issuance, every code cycle, the city has to actively adopt it and amend it. So it's not just, you know, that's more, I feel like that's a little bit more professional. So just to reference that the city, before a version of building code can take in effect, the city council has to adopt it. So that ties to that, rather than just say time to time, kind of open-ended, but say as adopted. Current version as adopted. That's one comment. And then another comment I have, it's in the newer version. And thank you for picking up some of the superlative references. I think there's another one that's outstanding, and I just saw it now. Is on page 5 of the one that you just emailed out today, is a paragraph 30-18.5, bullet point C, 8, which is the last paragraph directly above 13-18.6. Again, there's a lot of words saying usable by the greatest number of people, the widest reasonable range of ability, the disability to the greatest extent possible. And I think those superlative verbiage need to be, I think that should be adjusted because it's impossible to meet that standard. So those are my comments. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. And any other comments or questions? Yes, Board Member Hahn.
Yeah, I'd like to offer my comments, and they relate to my earlier questions. It would be good to be able to insert for both the planning board and the chief building official the waiver to allow the ability for a full waiver or a partial waiver, so that's clear that it's not a black and white situation. And that, of course, requires a judgment call and maybe looking at the financials more closely. But I hate to see, you know, someone at has 21% versus 19, and then is all one or the other. It'd be nice to allow the ability, the flexibility to do a full or partial waiver, however that gets determined. So that's kind of one comment. Another comment is there, since townhome style is kind of a key reason for the waiver, and it's really a significant part of the amendment, suggesting maybe you might want to include a definition for what townhouse style is. I think for all of us, it's pretty obvious we know what a townhouse is, but for the purpose of the ordinance, maybe a definition of townhouse would be beneficial. Let's see, another comment I had was, oh, this has to do with clarifying the findings for the waivers for the chief building official. One, as I said earlier, might be good to somehow phrase that the waivers is based on the ability of the chief building officials under his authority of the you know, city's building code, for one, so that it doesn't, you know, cross over into perhaps some other considerations that the chief building official really is not under their authority. The second is just kind of clarification and the possible findings. For instance, as an example, it, what's clearly outlined to me is like in 30.18.5, you know, it's kind of listed what are the possible waivers that the planning board can make a finding for, and it lists three items. It'd be good if you could organize the waivers for the chief building official in the same way. You know, it, when I was trying to list what are the various findings, and they only need to make one that the chief building official can make, you know, I saw one financial hardship, there's one about topo conditions, there's one about the size and configuration of the site, maybe that's part of topo conditions, and there's the legal constraints one, which you've cleared, which would be good to clarify what you had explained in your response that it related to recorded easements or some site restrictions on the property. And then, and we'd be good to label those numerics because they kind of blend together, and I'm not sure, you know, which one the building official would be citing when they provide the waiver, either one or two and three or whatever it might be. So that's just kind of a way to help clarify that section. So those are my comments.
Any other, thank you so much, Board Member Sue.
Thank you for the presentation, and just want to also reiterate that we appreciate you making the edits from that long presentation we had before. I also just want to reiterate to Board Member Ruiz noting that, you know, the just looking at this closely and seeing how with the visibility and requirement to have accessible powder bathroom, I can see that being onerous, but you know, I think with the ability to have the waivers and also the town exemptions, you know, I think this all, generally speaking, makes sense. The other comment I'll make is, and I know we discussed this last time, this is trying to like list out the exemptions for the townhouse construction style. I kind of see what you tried to do here, and I think it makes sense, but when I tried just kind of reading it, you know, you kind of, you know, you read B and says this, the provisions of this section do not apply to, and then you read partial exemptions applicable to townhouse style construction, it isn't as smooth as I would have imagined it to be. And I think maybe one way you could do it, and I think this is probably the way you had it before, which was, I think you listed out townhouse, like you had one section for townhouse style construction, you know, 10 units or more, and what exceptions apply there, and then townhouse style construction for 10 units or less. And I'm wondering if we like want to go back to that or try some other way, but I'll kind of leave it to you. I'm not gonna try to live edit it, but I see what you're trying to do, and I want to acknowledge it. I think it's you're on the right track, but maybe there's a way you can tweak the way seven, just the top line of seven is written, so that it kind of flows naturally, because 1 through 6 is very clear, like okay, it doesn't apply to this, doesn't apply to this, doesn't apply to this. And then seven's like, you kind of mentioned that this is an exemption again, and then you kind of list out all this stuff. So, but otherwise, looking good. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, Board Member DeWeese.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Board Member So, for the comments, but I was wondering for bullet number seven, does it make sense to elevate at one level? So instead of being seven, it becomes letter C, partial exemption. So you have applicability, right? Except, and then you have partial applicability or partial exemptions. So that so B and seven are at the same level, mm-hmm. right? Because they're not a subcategory to one another.
Right. Yeah, you could say like in addition, townhouse style construction, you know, as you know defined, are subject to these partial exemptions, and then maybe like townhouse style construction with 10 units or more, and then townhouse style construction 10 units mm-hmm. or less. Sounds good.
I see where you're going. I think that's pretty easy to sort of just move a few clauses around to make it flow better. I think we can do that. That's fine. Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you. Any other comments or recommendations? Board Member Sahiba?
Yeah, thank you for all the comments that fellow board members gave. I'm on the same page there. I just wanted to acknowledge that the presentation that you gave was graphically very clear. I appreciate that. I am curious if when we get the materials in here, if we could make that presentation part of what we receive. I think it would be really useful. I don't know if there's a stagger that's happening between when this is sent out and when the presentation is put together. But I think it's quite useful if, I mean, this is kind of consistent between presentations and what we receive in the packet. I think it's helpful for the public as well, just to digest that with what's been outlined here. So, like I said, I thought your presentation was graphically very clear, and it's quite useful as a supplement to what's typically provided. So if we could make that happen in the future, that'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay. Seeing none, the staff was able to capture all that. There was a lot of comments and suggestions, so I just wanted to bring it back to the team and see if you wanted to, ask any follow-up.
Staff is asking the board to recommend approval with these comments that you've made to the City Council. I'd be happy to go over those comments with you here again, but we're confident that we can incorporate these changes into the draft ordinance and bring it before actually both the Commission on Persons with Disabilities next month, as well as the City Council for a first reading.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you so much.
And if I could chime in on that staff recommendation, there's also a recommendation regarding the CEQA compliance, that CEQA, that this project is exempt under the common sense exception to CEQA. And that's on the grounds that we are really making changes to the actual process as opposed to making substantive changes that will have an impact on the environment. And so typically that type of language change does not necessitate further environmental review. And so if you could make a finding that the project is exempt under CEQA, under the common sense exception, we would recommend that as well.
Mm, okay, that's helpful. Okay, great. And you're referring to the public comment that we received, the written public comment?
Yes.
Okay, got it. Okay.
Yes.
Great. And I did have one quick follow-up clarifying question related to Board Member Sudoise's suggestion on the California Building Code. I just wanted to hear from the attorney your reaction, I guess, to that in terms of, you know, the City Council having to amend these suggestions, like.
Right.
Yeah.
I think either way is fine. You know, sometimes City Councils don't get around to amending the building code in time, and so the uniform building code will just automatically go into effect without the council taking an action. So we'd have to tweak that language that was suggested a little bit to take into account that scenario, but other than that, I don't see a problem with the suggestion.
Okay, wonderful, great, thank you. Okay, and I guess, yeah, before we take a motion, staff was gonna summarize some of the changes, is that right?
All right, I'll go through these relatively quickly, but just to sort of identify the section that they are in and sort of the gist of the suggestion. So in definitions, as we just acknowledged, current version as adopted by the city of Alameda, wherever it appears, with language as necessary to acknowledge the circumstance under which the city council does not adopt building code changes in a timely manner. The suggestion for an inclusion of the definition for a townhouse in the definitions section. In the exemptions, a clarification, potential reconfiguration of exemptions 7A and B. Keep going through that one. The formatting for the waiver from the building official should be essentially mirroring the formatting for the waiver that the planning board currently has. As well as acknowledging whether it's a full or partial, and maybe there was some recommendation for allowing room for discretion there. And then clarity on what is meant by legal constraints, equivalent facilitation, and the building official deriving their jurisdiction or authority from the building code itself. So those were sort of the main changes there.
Thank you.
And
so
also, sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
And
no,
also the superlative verbiage in page 5, 30-18.5.C.8.
Excuse me, I had just put a star there, yes. The superlatives there as well.
Mm-hmm. I think there was also the equivalent facilitation per the uniform building code definition.
Yes, both legal constraints and equivalent facilitation could be clarified further in that waiver authority for the building official.
And Board Member Hahn?
Yeah, this doesn't have to do with, you captured all the amendments really well, I thought. This has to be, as I'm thinking about the process, since the building official is allowed to make a waiver related to site constraints or things like that, which to me can affect the site planning when the project gets reviewed by the planning board or by planning staff, is there, process-wise, When's the earliest stage that a chief building official can make his exemption finding? Like, for instance, if a project comes before us and the building official maybe have already determined that there are site constraints that warrants a waiver, and then the planning board gets it, and then, you know, there might be like discussion about, well, maybe you reconfigure the building or the site plan, or you reduce the units to remove. I mean, how does the interplay between the plan review at the earlier stages occur versus that with the chief building official? The chief building official would typically only make these findings when they file for the building permit application, but it seems like some of the issues might surface earlier in the more preliminary design stages of the project.
I think you're absolutely correct. The expectation would be that the building official would need to make this determination after staff has determined that the ordinance applies to the project, but prior to them receiving any entitlement approval. So presumably they would need, you know, some sort of planning entitlement for a project of this size. At that time, when we receive the plans for that project and we've determined that the universal design ordinance does apply, if the applicant wished to, you know, propose a waiver under this particular waiver authority, they would need to demonstrate to the building official that their financial hardship falls within the constraints defined there and, mm-hmm. you know, meets that 20% threshold. Yeah. So that's sort of the timing. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. And I guess the question is there a potential that a project comes before the planning board with that determination or preliminary determination made by the chief building official that somehow he's evaluated the financial hardship issue and that comes before the planning board as a recommendation for them. I'm just trying to think of timing. When does this occur?
So I suppose there could be a situation under which the building official had sufficient information to make a determination of that waiver prior to a planning board determination on an entitlement for the same project. Yes, I can see a situation in which that could happen.
Perhaps some preliminary indication to the planning board so we're aware that.
Yeah.
At that time. Okay, okay. That would probably be beneficial. I mean, it could occur at several areas along the process, I understand.
Right.
Great. Thank you so much for that comment. No other closing comments, then I want to thank staff for so much for the great work and presentation. This seems like a really great common sense change that's equitable for the community and also will make these type of developments that much more feasible. So thank you so much. All right. We have to make a motion, right? And anyone have a motion to make? We had the changes summarized, so.
I'll move to adopt the resolution recommending adoption of the amendments to the Universal Design Ordinance with the changes we discussed today.
Okay, do we have a second?
And also the CEQA finding, right?
Yes, and the CEQA findings, thank you.
Mm-hmm. I second.
Great, we have a motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions, and that motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you.
That closes item 5A. We'll go ahead and move to item 5B, which is naming of streets for Alameda Point tentative map.
Good evening again. I'm Steve Buckley, Planning Services Manager, and I'll run through the presentation on this request by the developers of the Reshape and West Midway projects. You're familiar with those projects as they've come through the planning process over a series of hearings approved in December of 2023. And there's been subdivision maps and development plans and design review. And this request here is just to rename a couple of streets within the subdivision that was previously approved. The city has a naming policy, which was in your packet, and it addresses parks, various other facilities, like fire stations and things like that, and also streets. And it has different categories of naming, including new projects, renaming, for instance, like a park or a street that has an old name and gets a new name. We've seen that around town a couple of times. Corporate names, which might be, for instance, like the Wind River Business Park, and they have their own street name. And then Alameda Point has its own category as well, with reference to historic and military naval themes. Being the requirement there. So this city naming policy applies here. And this is the subdivision lot that you've seen before. This is in anticipation of the build out of the development plan, the master development plan. The Reshape, the affordable housing project, is on the west, west of Ardent Way. That's already a named street. Orion Street is also already a named street, and Skylark. And those are streets that have been there in some configuration very similar since when the Navy left. However, there were these two other placeholder streets, Avenue B and A Street, that were included on the map just as placeholders. No one has ever used that address, lived there, had a business there, and all the buildings there are vacant except lot 21 up in the northwest corner is Building 35, it's still standing and it's being used as a daycare center. And that's actually not part of the affordable housing project. But the rest of it will be developed in the coming years. Site preparation has already started. West Midway Avenue is already under construction as a new slow street with all the necessary infrastructure. And so we're here tonight just to name Avenue B and A Street with real names. Those streets, like I said, they don't exist. There aren't any streets out there that go along those stretches. So in fact, we're not really renaming, we're just sort of giving them new names. Waves on the west side there refers to the women's auxiliary that was brought to the base during World War II, and that's explained in your staff report. There's a lot of history on this site. Lot 8 is actually occupied by Building 78 right now. It's been approved for demolition to clear the way for this development project, but it was one of the buildings that the Waves participants lived and worked in. And then Valor Avenue on the east end was chosen by the developer, the market rate developer for the eastern side of the project. They actually went through several names and found that the old list that has been circulating has already been exhausted pretty much by all the other new development around town. So there were sort of a menu of suggested names, and they kept coming up against Google Maps telling them that that was already taken. They finally found a name that they like that has a sort of a military naval theme. And so we believe that both of these names are appropriate, and we recommend that you approve it.
Excellent. Thank you for the presentation. I guess we'll open up for clarifying questions from the board. Board member Hoffman?
Yeah, just one very simple question. Is the idea that maybe Wave Street, you know, like when you look like a potential street kind of to the west, is there thought that maybe Wave Street will be the area to the west of Pan Am Way might also be called Waves Avenue too? Is that the thought?
Probably not. That section there is actually more of an alley, a service alley and parking lot that serves the
street.
Two businesses there.
Okay.
So yeah, that's not really a street. It's more of a driveway.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Just wondering.
Any other clarifying questions? Seeing none. Okay. Thank you so much for the presentation. With that, we'll open up to public comment.
None online.
And with that, we'll go ahead and close public comment and bring it back to the board for any comments or thoughts. Again, this is a recommendation for City Council for these names for the Reshape and Midpoint Project. Board Member Hom.
Yeah, I'll make a motion to move to support the recommendation to renaming B Avenue and A Street to Wave Avenue and Fowler. As recommended.
Okay, great.
I second it.
All right, we have a motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
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 Oppose?
Sorry, is there a CEQA finding we should be making too?
Yes, the attached resolution contains the common sense exception as well.
Okay, okay, sorry. I should have included that in the motion too.
No worries. All right, with that amendment to the motion, I think the ayes still have it. Any nays? Abstentions? All right, and that motion passes. Okay, and we're done with the regular agenda items. We'll move on to staff communications.
Yes, under 6A, you have in your packet an attachment that discusses three small projects that were recently approved by staff through the design review process. And those are currently in the appeal period. They've been publicly noticed. 6B, we're mapping out a few more meetings coming up. You've got some interesting projects, including the Pacific Fusion project that you may have heard of. And so that will be coming to you fairly soon. We're working with the applicant to prepare a development plan for your review, and also a CEQA streamlining checklist.
Okay, great, thank you for that update. Do we do a public comment for this? I forgot, for item six?
Yes.
Okay, any public comments?
None online.
Okay, we'll close public comment. Moving on to board communications. Okay, seeing none. All right, item eight is non-agenda public comments. So if there's anything that anyone would like to speak about that was not on the agenda, now is your time.
No one online?
Okay, great, thank you. And with that, we're adjourned. Thank you.